Welcome to Nightlife, a bite-size episode.
If you grew up on meat and three veg night after night, then you know all too well that until relatively recently, Australia's food was, well, perhaps a little dull. Depending how old you are, you might have grown up in a household without vegetables such as avocado or capsicum, chili, or maybe especially garlic, which was all a bit exotic until post-World War II migration changed the kinds of foods that Australians were eating. Our guest tonight, food writer John Newton, sees Australia's embrace of garlic as an important step in developing the food culture we have today. And he's joined us tonight to look back at how our attitude to food has changed since 1788 and to talk about his new book, The Getting of Garlic. John, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Philip, good evening.
Lovely to have you with us. Why is garlic the metaphor for Australia's world into the entry into the world of interesting food?
Not sure so much a metaphor as a touchstone. I mean, I suppose I chose it because it coincided with another very important moment in modern Australian food history, which was the arrival of the jumbo jet.
Oh, really?
In 1972. Oh. And my epiphany with garlic happened in the Costa Brava, which you may remember. In Liverpool Street, I don't know whether you do or not, but no. I was confronted with a bowl of garlic prawns sizzling in oil with chili, and it was the first time I had ever encountered garlic used as a weapon of breath destruction, rather than as my mother used to do it, just wiping it around the edge of the bowl and then throwing it away. And I thought, my God, that's wonderful. But that was sort of. It wasn't so much, I don't think, the 1945 period when they started arriving, because we still rejected people then. We still rejected their food. Peter Zenos told me, the guy who's got a cafe in Crow's Nest, that up until 1969, they would say to him, his neighbours would say to him, please don't use garlic, it stinks.
Well, exactly. I mean, and there'd be many, because it does, there'd be many people, of course, who would remember this entirely. The whole British attitude towards garlic is odd, really, isn't it? Because we inherited English food. I mean, at least the white settlement here inherited English food. They arrived, they brought English food with them. But the English were pretty negative about garlic. In fact, they still are, because The Queen hates it. The Queen apparently hates it, and you can't serve it to her in any form in any of her food.
Mrs. Beaton, there's a quote from Mrs. Beaton in there, and it was garlic was not used in Anglo Celtic or British food for a long time.
Why is that? Because it's just a long standing flavouring. You'd think it would have found its way into English food.
I got a feeling it was to do with the hatred of the French,
right?
You know, and the Italians. The British never liked the Continentals very much, you know. They went there under sufferance, except the upper classes, of course. The upper classes loved it, but the British people were very suspicious of Italians and frogs, and especially the frogs, because they fought with them for ages. So Mrs. Beaton actually says that. She says it's a vile stuff that smells awful, but it's particularly liked by the Italians and the French. And I think that's what it was. So, there's no doubt that it wasn't in evidence in British cooking, in Anglo-Celtic cooking or in British cooking.
So it's just really chauvinism in a way, national chauvinism,
that's right.
rather than any dislike of the ingredient.
Because garlic was another symbol of another cultures that were inferior to British.
Yes, so there's an age-old debate, of course, as to whether Australia has any of its own food culture.
Ah, it's not a debate at all.
What do you think about that? Do you think it has? Some people say, the Lamington or the Pavlova, but as we know, actually, none of these claims stand up for very long, because the Pavlova was certainly not an Australian dish, and the Lamington, well, almost certainly not as well. Might have got popular here, but it certainly wasn't. Well, it didn't grow out of our culture.
Well, there's a very substantial scholarly book written on the Lamington by a man called Professor Maurice French. I think it's called The Enigma of the Lamington. And yes, it's no doubt it's Australian, but no one knows where it was invented or by whom. I mean, it came here, but it's a sweet. And the important thing, I think, we've got to go back a couple of things. You say food culture. I don't think we have any. One of the sort of subplots of this book is discovering the fact that we don't have a food culture, and there's no point in looking for one because not having it is a positive in many ways because we don't have anything to conform to, so we can do what we like.
So there's no such thing as a national dish or Australian food.
There's no such thing as a national or regional dish, except I did find one.
Mm.
I did well. There's two exceptions to that. True, that is true. There is no equivalent of a paella or any kind of Italian dish in Australia. They're not there. But there were two. Firstly, I found one regional dish, which is the Adelaide pie floater.
This is a pie floating in a pool of mushy peas.
That's exactly right. Mm. There's a lot of places where they pour the.
Is that really? Because that would seem to me to be an English thing.
Well, it's only in Adelaide does the pie go into the peas rather than the peas go into the pie. And they claim it as their own, and I accept that it's a...
Although, in a way, it's really, as you say, because, I mean, the English have always put mushy peas into the pie.
Yeah. They've put them on the pie, but in Adelaide, the pie floater, they're very proud of the pie floater. And the other exception is a group of people called the Barossa Deutsch.
Hmm.
And they came out here in the early 19th century as religious refugees from some strange religious problem over there. And they settled in the Barossa Valley. And unlike other parts of Australia, they started with mixed farms. They had small mixed farms. So they had a peasant culture.
Hmm.
And they imported their culture with them, their food culture. And they did things like substitute berry for a berry that was in Silesia they couldn't get. They substitute Shiraz grapes, so they did have a food culture here, but it petered out because of anti-German sentiment.
One of the arguments put forward about why we failed to develop a food culture. I'm talking with John Newton, by the way, food writer, and he's written an interesting book called The Getting of Garlic about the history of food in Australia. One of the ideas put forward about why we failed to develop our own cuisine is that we haven't been here long enough. You say, well, fair argument, but there are other examples of cultures younger than ours that have developed quite strong national food.
Well, about the same age as ours. Yeah. I mean, the one that I think is most powerful is the Mauritian one.
Right.
And Mauritius is very, very similar in age to Australia. They arrived, the French arrived and brought their African slaves, and then of course the Chinese arrived, as they always do, and then the Indians arrived. And they have a culture, they have extraordinary food culture, which is like an archaeological layer of those components.
Yeah. Is one of the reasons, do you think, that when we arrived, there was a fair bit of knowledge and mixing in a way with Indigenous Australians? But there doesn't ever seem to have been much borrowing of food or much interest in Indigenous cuisine in any way. That, in other words, when we arrived, we brought our packets packets of food with us. We never really seemed to have thought, what does this country produce?
No, we didn't. That's right.
That's unique here that we could actually start eating. I mean, people were still addicted to tea and sugar and flour,
and
we never seem to have got past that. Do you think that's
quite true? Because the original inhabitants, the Georgians, held the indigenous people in very low regard, and they thought they were wandering savages, and they didn't have much to do with them except to try and wipe them out. There was a huge one of the things that I'm sad about this book. I didn't realise is a terrific book called The Sydney Wars, and I wasn't aware of how strongly the indigenous people in Sydney were fighting. I knew a little bit from reading Pemulwuy, but they fought. They were huge battles between the early colonisers and the indigenous people. So the last book I wrote was called The Oldest Foods on Earth, and that was about the fact that we ignored, just as well, totally ignored those foods when we came here.
Yeah. What do you think about the current... There's a current kind of fashion, isn't there, for finding indigenous flavours? And we talk about lemon myrtle and lime flavours and so on, natural Australian flavours. Do you think it's just a fad, or is it likely to take hold?
I certainly hope not. Because I think it means that we're becoming more comfortable with the country.
Hmm.
I think we're becoming, in many ways, more comfortable with the Indigenous Australians, although there's still a lot of nastiness around, but I think we're becoming more comfortable there, and I think getting an interest in those foods shows we're becoming more comfortable living here.
Mm.
For many years, we were not comfortable living here. We were diseased in the country. We huddled around the edges, and we just didn't really, really want to be here.
It was the migrant experience after the war that really changed things, though, wasn't it? I mean, along comes salami and garlic and smelly food and all sorts of things, and all of a sudden it changes dramatically.
But I don't think that's quite true, because it didn't change dramatically. The migrants arrived, say, from the huge numbers from 45 all the way through till, say, the 60s. Hmm. It wasn't until, as I just said earlier, I don't think Bill Marchetti said to me once, a very good Australian chef, he said, the hero to me in all this is the jumbo jet, because when that plane arrived, we took off. We had all these neighbours, WOGs and REFOs, but we sort of held them at arm's length. But when we all took off and went to Europe and went to Asia and went to all these places and came back, we realised that what we'd be missing. Yeah. And that was when the food changed. So I think it was that outflow and return that was the most important thing.
A lot of it was availability too, wasn't it? I mean, I remember growing up, I mean, you couldn't buy many things.
No,
if you went
to
the greengrocer, you could buy oranges and bananas and, you know...
Washed potatoes and unwashed potatoes.
And lettuce and cauliflower. Yeah. Those are many. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't buy a lot of things.
That's right.
And a lot of people actually grew their own stuff at home.
Yeah.
So...
Well, especially the migrants.
Yeah. So when did we start seeing shops full of stuff?
It was a gradual thing. As we began to accept these things, we began to look for them, and we got more and more. The migrants came out of their shells and said, well, we've got this stuff, and they smuggled stuff in that came in. I can remember an Italian chef mate of mine saying he and his mother were at walk past a shop in Blacktown, I think they were, and they saw horse meat, and they were so excited they could eat horse, because no one eats horse here, but they did. Mm. So these things gradually arrived over time, and now I think we've got more of everything than any other country on earth.
What would you say the Australian national dish is now?
Spaghetti
bolognese.
I think it's useless looking for one.
Chicken or sort of Asian stir fry.
I mean, Charmaine Solomon taught us to love Asian food, and she probably set off the huge, number of woks in every household with her wonderful encyclopedia of Asian food.
The Complete Asian Cookbook.
The Complete Asian Cookbook
by Charmaine Solomon was a hugely influential book.
You've got one. I've got one. And when I walk into any kitchen I walk into, I see it there, and it's always splattered.
Yeah.
That was a very important book.
Yeah, I guess so too. And I suppose television was important too, wasn't it?
Television became important, but I think the book came first.
Yeah.
I think the book.
One of the interesting
first.
Things you talk about in your book is that when you look back at the early cookbooks, the Country Women's Association cookbooks, etc.
Oh, that was wonderful.
The number of cakes and biscuits and slices and generals, in other words, general sweet things, way outnumbered the rest of the recipes. So cooking was by and large seen as something that involved sugar or dessert.
Well, there's a whole lot of discussion in the book about that. I mean, why was that? I mean, one thing I think was that because of the unsophistication of our meat use generally, of our meals, it was just a slab of meat, either roast or, fried.
Yeah.
So creativity for women became the creation of all these beautiful cakes and scones, and they gave that, and that was what they swapped when they swapped recipes. I think the other thing was when they started to compete, and there was a huge amount of competition in food, you couldn't sort of have a competition where you had the best roast. The portable foods were the cakes and the preserves and those sort of things. So those are the things that became the province of women and the most important things. And it was, dainty food was the thing that we wanted women to give us against the roughness of a hunk of mutton on the fire.
And of course, these days almost everyone seems to eat garlic, don't they? Or not?
I guess so. I pity those who don't, Philip.
Yeah. And, food writers and, I suppose, for that matter, too, cooking shows, which have become immensely popular, have made the idea that we can eat anything. What do you think our food culture resembles most closely in terms of other countries?
Oh, I suppose the other settler nations like America and, say... More and more, I suppose. Yeah, no. America. America's the main one. And the English are catching up with us at last, of course. But well, I think we have something different. I think we have much more of a much more eclectic way of looking at food. Hmm. What I call bricolage, you know, the way that, because we have this vast array of ingredients, a cook like Peter Gilmore has all these things to choose from. And I think much more than they do in America.
Hmm. Interesting. All right, John, good to talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.